to Dasco Up for Discussion, the podcast where we celebrate inclusion, share stories, and spotlight the amazing work happening in our community. Today, we're joined by someone who has dedicated her entire career to empowering individuals with disabilities through education, science, and advocacy, Dr. Annie Bagdayan. Nice Yay. To have you with us.
Thank you.
Annie's the Executive Director of the National Center for Disability Education and Training, and she's also a good friend of mine because our kids went to daycare together, and that's how we originally met like 20 years ago. Yes. Isn't that crazy?
Yes, yes. Time flies.
And it was just serendipitous that I had Kirsten and, you know, you were right there.
Yes.
So what a fun way to be for me to have you as my sidekick to offer advice and support. But Dr. Bagdayan is a board-certified behavior analyst at the doctoral level and an accomplished leader in special education and behavioral science. In this episode, we're going to explore her journey into applied behavioral analysis, the mission of her programs at OU, and how she and her team are shaping brighter futures for individuals with disabilities in Oklahoma and beyond. So let's jump right into it and welcome Annie. And
thank you.
First, right out of the gate, just tell us, like, why? Why? What made you get into the field of ABA?
Well, ABA was very novice to me, and I didn't know anything about it until I actually started my master's program in special education at the University of Oklahoma, and it was in my first class, Intro to ABA as Teachers. So it got me interested, and then one of my role was to conduct a class project where I met a little boy, a nine-year-old, who changed my life, and kind of because of his learning and progress that he made, I decided to pursue as a BCBA and learn more about ABA because I saw immediately the impact of that teaching method on a nine-year-old who was nonverbal, extremely aggressive, and that's kind of where I started.
Mm-hmm. And I know you've done some sessions with us, but just tell the listener out there, because I'm sure everybody gets confused on what is ABA therapy.
So ABA is the science. As far as the therapy, you are either going to be a BCBA or a technician level person. It's a tier system. As a BCBA, we are working with individuals to teach them skills, to teach them adaptive skills, whatever skills they need, from a home base to their challenging behaviors, and by teaching them those skills and data-driven decision-making, if there's progress, that means that that intervention is really working. So you're either working with a family if you're in a home base, if you're working with the teachers, it's literally a tier system of support where put into the individual and the needs of that individual to teach them socially significant behaviors and more appropriate behaviors.
And is it more geared towards people or individuals who have autism? Is that what it's designed? Was it originally designed for?
It's
with Down syndrome, need ABA therapy.
Yes. But. Yeah, it's not designed for autism. ABA is the field of behavioral science where you can actually take it and use it with anyone. It does not have to have a disability. So as an organizational leader, mm-hmm. I use it with my staff as nice. in their performance. So ABA is not only for autism. ABA is for everyone who needs a change in behavior, whether in a drug addict or someone who's smoking or someone who really needs to change the way they talk to others, you mm-hmm. know? So it's a behavioral change mechanism in style where you have to gather all the information, what's triggering that, and then make all the adjustments and reinforce more appropriate and socially significant behaviors.
Okay, yes. I know we get a lot of questions on that, you know, the confusion between occupational therapy and behavioral therapy. But so can you share some of your ABA successes or stories about what's happened in your career path?
I have been a BCBA for a little over 13, 14 years now. And before that, part of becoming a BCBA, you have to do field experience mm-hmm. hours. So you're working with families, with children in the school, in their natural environment. That's what I feel comfortable with. I will tell you that one of my success stories that brings tears to my eyes a lot of time was I was working at a summer school as an instructional tutor back in the day where there were no registered behavior technicians. So I had a mom walk in with her three-year-old, because as soon as a child turns three,
right,
they are eligible for DD program, developmental disability programs in the public school system. So she walked in with this little boy who was just kicking and hitting and nonverbal. His mom told us that she actually had him sit on a chair and buckles him just because he won't sit still. Long story short, after the summer program, which summer schools are not more than 6 weeks,
uh-huh,
this kid left the summer school with at least 50 words communicating, saying, "I want to eat." And we did not have to actually put him in a high chair, uh-huh, or any chair. He understood that he needed to sit down for 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And mom was just, impressed at how one-on-one, directly working with him, he had made such a progress in a very short period of time.
So would you say the key is just those constant reinforcements in ABA?
The key is knowing how to teach.
Hmm.
And reinforcing appropriate behaviors. So not everybody learns the same way. And if we're using one way fits all model, it's not going to work with all these kids, everyone. So it was very much catered to his need, individualized. And then his rewards, his reinforcers were different. So then he started saying things that he really liked, yeah, before he said, "Mommy" or "Mama."
Yeah.
You know? So, aww, yes. Yeah.
What a great story. Now, Annie, I know you're at the National Center for Disability Education and Training. Can you kind of just explain what you all do? Because we work closely with you all on several contracts.
So the National Center for Disability Education and Training, we focus on teaching employment and for individuals with disabilities, and also building the community, mm-hmm, as far as what are the strengths of individuals with disabilities? How can they be a good citizens by having a job and, yes, contributing, teaching not only the individuals, but also teaching our community that once we are teaching these skills, where are they going to go? They need employers. They need businesses. We need workforce to understand their contribution to the society. Mm-hmm. So National Center literally focuses on building the capacity of our businesses, and also works with the student, with the schools and the students in the public schools to help bridge that gap and build a community where it's more diverse and inclusive for our learners with exceptionalities.
Now, are you just working on groups in Oklahoma, or is it all across the state?
I know that the name may be confusing, yeah, and I think the name of the center has been driven. The National Center exists for a little over 65 years.
Okay.
So the reason why it was called National Center, because it was a hub for a lot of national trainings. But as contracts and funding sources evolved, right now we currently focus on the state of Oklahoma statewide.
Great, great, great. And I know a couple of the services that y'all provide are pre-ets. And we actually have a contract with you to teach pre-ets. And the schools do that too. Can you kind of explain what pre-ets is?
Well, pre-employment transition services, and the short version of it is the pre-ets, is a service where it made available in 2014 because of the Work and Innovation Opportunity Act. And then Oklahoma actually started doing it, implementing it with partnership with the Oklahoma DRS transition coordinators. And we piloted in 2019, and then right now we are in year six. But what it is based on five pillars, where we're teaching student self-advocacy is one, job exploration, job counseling, post-secondary education. And then we employ specialists who are either a retired teacher or teachers who are no longer wanting to teach in a school setting, different disciplines, people who are going into the school and working one-on-one or a small group with the students and the teachers in the classroom, teaching those employability skills.
Yeah, and we teach that here, and this is our third year or maybe our fourth year with the Self-Advocacy Center. And my gosh, we love the curriculum. Robin loves teaching the trainings to our self-advocates, and now we've had some really good success stories after pre-ets where they are obtaining jobs. So it's actually working. So we really appreciate that.
Yeah, working on those five pillars, you know, self-advocacy is one of them, and helping them progressively to get to the place where they can do work-based learning and they're actually holding jobs.
Yes.
And then that transitions into an actual employment, whether that's part-time or full-time or a few hours. The goal is to have a job they can perform independently with a minimal support.
And I think we probably have about 95% of our group that have actually in full-time employment now. But we've had a couple that have come back that need a little bit extra support that are getting that extra year. But as far as like the disability education group, tell us about your team and your approach and how you guys, you know, uniquely have an effect on the disability community.
So PRE-ETS is one of our programs. In addition to PRE-ETS, we are also, you know, I would like to kind of draw a picture of what is in National Center for Disability Education and Training so that you see the diverse team that we have. So PRE-ETS is one of our programs. We have another program that's also in partnership with the Oklahoma Department of Rehabilitation Services. It's Project Search.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have another program, again, with partnership with Oklahoma DRS, where we are training in the community. There are employment consultants or job coaches.
Yes.
They have to go through our trainings. We have a curriculum that is aligned by national competencies. And right now our curriculum is being reviewed. And once it passes that accreditation process, so anyone goes through that training will be nationally certified as well. And then the other program we have is Oklahoma Work Incentive and Assistance Project, where all these projects work, they don't work in silo. So we collaborate together. If we have a pre-ed student who is still needing some support or some sort of a supported setting where they're still needing to learn and practice those skills, they could be a perfect candidate for Project Search.
Yes.
And Project Search is not in the schools. It is done in partnership with schools. So recruitment could be a challenge for them. So then our pre-eds are referring students to Project Search. Now they're completing Project Search and they have a job offer, but they receive SSI or SSDI, they are beneficiaries. And then our work incentive planning program comes into the picture and helps them understanding like, hey, it's okay to have a job. Let's do a benefit analysis. As a high schooler, they have different rules and different caps as far as their income, and a lot of people are scared that they're going to lose their benefits.
That
education comes into place, and we have three staff members who have gone through the Virginia Commonwealth University's certification program, so they're fully certified, and we serve the entire state of Oklahoma. So it's good to know that they call and they talk to a person.
Yes.
And that person looks into their details and provides them that information.
Mm-hmm.
So being a team like this, there's no way we could say that that's all WIPA, that's PRE-ETS, that's, you know, we have to work together. And when we get together, new people, new PRE-ETS specialists don't know what a WIPA is, don't know what Project Search is. So we want to make sure that they all understand internally so that they promote it outside the department.
Yes, and I think a great example, Kirsten just finished Best Step Camp, and I know the applications are coming out soon for that.
Yeah.
That was a great program for her just to, you know, gain some more job experience. And, you know, she loves clocking in. That was her favorite thing, you know, because she got to use her phone independently.
But yes, and clocking means you get paid, you know. So
well, she'd ask that's to see to her money, paid. And I would show her the account, like, oh, it's right here.
Yeah.
But that was just a great program for her for the summer and really kept her kind of going and like, oh, I do want to work or I do want to do these things. I think it for the parent side, it gave her such confidence and actually made me let go of the apron strings a little bit, because I was like, I don't know, can she, is she going to be able to do this? You know, her working by herself with somebody I don't really know personally, she did awesome.
Yeah. That because they're supported, we are checking in on them. Our skills trainers talk to the businesses, talk to the students, and make sure that they are, everything is going well. There are times that not everything is going well, so then we need to intervene. But Best Step has been an amazing experience for many of our 16 and older students, because if the opportunity is not forced to the businesses, then these children are not really working in the summer or knocking at doors, applying for jobs. Without that support in place, they're not really experiencing that. So that learning experience has been amazing. We do offer about 25 camps statewide, and the applications are out. So they were actually published and released and launched on Monday. And the applications will close on March 1st.
And we'll put out a link to those on this podcast so that families can go and check that out. And remind me what the age limit is for that again.
We prefer to have them 16 and older, but 16 to 22 is when, once their 22nd birthday, they turn into a different program, and then access different programs. But they have to be enrolled in a school, whether they're seniors or super seniors, as long as they're finishing school, then that summer is going to help them, you know, learn that employability skills. And then Best finishes, and the next week they start their work experience, which is their STEP experience.
Yes, and I highly recommend it. It's a really great program, and gave her a lot of, like I said, I think the main thing we walked away with confidence, but for me to realize, she could do these things, and I don't have to hover, and I didn't have to do it. I think that was the best part, is I didn't have to be there. You kind of gave me some respite.
Accessing support, you know, and resources that are available in our state. And if we don't know about them, we're not using them, you know.
Absolutely. So, but we'll put that link out there so that everybody go apply. And some might say, I think you had over 600 applicants, something like last year.
We had more than 500 applicants last year. And then the application process, once it's complete, there's an interview process. So we need to make sure that the team decides that they are a good and eligible candidate for Best and STEP.
It's great.
With teacher references, parents, and everyone contribute to that decision making.
It's great. I mean, we appreciate you all, you know, and all that you do. I mean, there's so many parts to the center, and I don't think people realize that you're such a great resource to us as families, but also to the Down Syndrome Association as an organization resource. And I work with other affiliates too, and they're like, that's a great resource to us. So that's one of the things that we really appreciate.
Thank you.
We're gonna dive back into ABA a little bit more. Because I think there are some, you know, misconceptions about ABA, and if can you kind of talk a little bit about some of those that we as parents might not understand?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is that ABA is equal to candies.
Okay.
That's the first thing people think. People think that ABA is equal to M&Ms or Skittles or little candies that need to be provided to anyone who is receiving ABA services. ABA is not about candies. ABA is about assessing the reinforcer of the individual, what gets them going. And I can quickly give you an example. I was working with a family that have a 7-8-year-old who was nonverbal. The goal of the parent was definitely mom wanted her son to say mommy. And that's pretty normal thing to ask. So when I start working with him, he had no words, and we tried everything. We tried to figure out what really what is it that is going to keep him going or asking. So his first word was tickle.
Tickle.
This kid loved to tickle. One day I was leaving their house, and mom was crying and saying, when is he going to say it? And he actually pulled my pants and made me turn around, and he said, tickle, tickle, tickle. And then I know we both, you know, we're like, okay, we're tickling you. And then once he realized the power of uttering that word,
yeah,
then mommy came next and then other words came next. So I don't believe it's about the candies. It's about whatever that's going to make that kid say. For some, their first word is outside. For some is apple. It could be whatever, hug, up. Whatever is going to make them reinforced, that's mm-hmm. what we're going to use. The other biggest misconception that I want to highlight is ABA is 40 hours of direct therapy, one-on-one, and it's not. ABA is not about 40 hours of intensive therapy. That's an intensive therapy for some kids who need it. Mm-hmm. But for some others, it could be just 5 hours mm-hmm. or less. It's what they need. It has to be individualized. So as a special educator, as anyone who works in the with exceptional individuals, there's no one-size-fits-all model.
Yeah.
If you are working with an ABA therapist or a BCBA who says that, oh, this is, you either take 20 hours or none, it's, how is that individualized? What if my child doesn't need 20 hours? What mm-hmm. if we only need 5 to 10 hours? Mm-hmm. So it has to be catered to the need of the family and the child.
Yeah. And I know one of the things that we get questioned here a lot is about potty training.
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of talk a little bit about that and its relation to, you know, ABA therapy?
Potty training and ABA, you know, when you're using behavioral techniques to support and teach a skill, which is mm-hmm. the we're assessing the readiness. Mm-hmm. We'll see if the kid is ready to actually pull their pants down, pull their pants out. Yeah. And then what kind of experiences do they have with the restroom? You know,
yeah.
Is it aversive? We got to turn it into a place where they are excited to go in, mm-hmm. sit down or stand up or sit in the potty or whatever ways would work for that child. That's the technique that's going to be used. So again, I know that some people believe in sitting down for mm-hmm. hours and putting, mm-hmm. and then by the time they're partying, they're eating, they're playing, they have an iPad and sitting down mm-hmm. because we wanted this. The potty has to be a place where you sit down, go pee-pee, go mm-hmm. whatever. And they need to understand that we sit, we go, we flush, we leave, we wash our hands, and there's a process. And if kids are at a point where they understand that sequential tasks of what I mm-hmm. need to do, first we may start by just pulling down, sitting, going, and practicing those skills. If they don't have the readiness skills, then you are literally working months and months and months without any success. When there is no progress, that means the intervention method that we're using for teaching potty training is useless at that point. It's frustrating to the learner. It's also frustrating for the person who's training, whether yeah. that's a mom or a therapist. So literally knowing where to meet the child as far as their mm-hmm. skill set.
Yeah. So that phrase, your time, your terms, kind of does mm-hmm. apply.
Yeah.
To make them have a complete understanding. Are there any tips out there you'd say to just get them introduced to the bathroom setting? Like that you...
Don't make it aversive. I think if it is a place where go time out, it's not pleasant. If it's if you don't sit down, I'm going to do this, then why would I sit? There's no need for me. So make it more of a, if you just sit down for a few seconds, then reward them for their sitting skill. A lot of kids is that their social development has to be at a place where they are ready to sit and discharge, whether that's urinating or, you know, going number two in the potty.
Yes.
But for kids to feel comfortable to do that, for some kids, it's flushing the toilet could be extremely aversive. Really understanding what exactly is positive and build on that positive experience accordingly.
Mm-hmm. I know you've done a session with us on, you know, what's a behavioral issue and what's a sensory issue. Mm-hmm. And that was always really fascinating to me because I think for kids with Down syndrome, they're they're very tricky and very manipulative, yeah. and they like yeah. to get their way. So can you just touch a little bit on what the difference between those two are and maybe how we as parents navigate that?
Well, if you are only, you know, you're any child, not only child with Down syndrome, they are little manipulators.
Yes, they are.
And I say that onset of age two, that's when that usually yep. starts. And yeah. they know what. How to throw a fit, or when you're on the phone, they want your attention, you know, and then you're frustrated. Like, why are you doing this when I'm only on the phone? Well, they're seeking your attention.
Yes.
That's an attention-seeking behavior. So when you are examining and observing your child's ability outside the potty, outside the restroom, you will be able to tell that they're just refusing just because it's easier.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then somehow being strict and then saying, no, we're going to try this. We have to try this. At least trying. By trying, once it, young children learn routine faster than us as adults do. Really? So once it becomes a routine, then definitely it is a easier process for them to transition from not wanting to do it. And there's a, you know, there's a celebration afterward. There's a tension. There's mm-hmm. this. It definitely becomes like, oh, I'm getting all this positive attention. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do it now because it's, they think it's on their terms, but you also put that demand on them and made them comply to your demands. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're not, you know, otherwise you're not going to celebrate. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're not going to get positive reinforcement.
Any tips on, this made me think of our kids are good escape artists. So how does that apply in your world as a BCBA?
For us behaviors, we have to learn whether they're seeking attention or they're escaping a demand or a task. Yeah. If it is escaping, teaching them how to escape it appropriately in the first place. And then the next time, it's a progression of learning. So if you want to escape, throwing yourself on the floor, throwing these on the floor, you're not going to escape a task. Mm-hmm. You need a break. Hand this to me and say, I need a break. You still reinforce escape, but in a more appropriate way.
Letting them communicate back to you.
And absolutely. Like, and then here's what I'm done say with. That you don't want to do this. I understand, but I need you to do only one. While that trust is established that you understand me, you know that I don't want to do this and I want to escape this. You know what I'm communicating, that trust eventually turns into like, okay, well, since you're getting me, mm-hmm. I'm going to do this favor for you just because you asked me. That's when we talk about generalizing it. You know, mm-hmm. sometimes they'll do something for one person, but they won't do it with others. And then we're like, why is he or she doing this for you and that they won't do it for me? Because they've learned that relationship building and they trust, they know that I'm gonna give them that break, but I just need them to do a little something for me. And then you actually thin that schedule of reward even more and say, okay, this time you did this, next time I want you to do two of these. And then gradually get to the point where we've literally established that relationship where you do one page and you take a break. And then you're still reinforcing escape, but in a way more reasonable and socially appropriate way.
How about like when we're at the grocery store? How do we deal with that?
Well, the grocery store is a perfect place, actually, to get all the attention.
Explore.
And to do all kinds of behavior.
Mischievous.
Because you are not responding to your child the way you normally would if you're mm-hmm. not being watched by people. Mm-hmm. Because we are being watched, a lot of times we feel like we're being judged.
Yes.
So we start so doing things and say things that are not consistent the way you would handle the situation. Mm-hmm. My first example of the children manipulating behavior is usually in a grocery store. And then the way you respond to that would be the likelihood of that behavior happening in the future in the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are giving in and saying, hush, everybody's watching us, just take this and be quiet, mm-hmm. then you reinforce inappropriate behavior. And guess mm-hmm. what? good luck with that the next time and the next time. And the more they've learned that if I do this, I get rewarded. So the next time I need to be louder. I need to do more of this, more of this, and make it a scenic and drama and everything where everyone is watching. But you are in a position where you're going to respond to it because you're being watched and you're just going to end it right now.
But is it good to prep, like, and say, hey, you know, Kirsten, we're getting ready to go into the grocery store, and my expectation is that you stay beside me, walk by the cart. We're not going to touch things. If you'd like to look at something, let me know. I mean, is it good to do those kinds of things?
It really depends on the age of the individual. So if I'm taking a two-year-old, definitely I'm going to deal with that differently. If I'm taking a six, seven-year-old, probably have a picture expectation.
Yeah, some visuals.
But I love the expectation card, and you have to prep them before you go in there. And instead of you being the bad person in the equation, you're just going to refer that. Okay, look at what we talked about. Okay, this is what
here's
we agreed.
Your visual.
Here's your visual, and even if it's just a few points and words, she knows that I need to walk by you. I need to do this. I need to do that. And then prompt cards are visuals which take away the anger from the individual who is just being the constant nagger and saying, we do not do this. Walk by me. How many times did I tell you? By doing that, we are attending to the behavior. And then in that instance, that's all I want. I don't care if it's positive or negative. I'm getting your attention.
Yeah. We're suckers, aren't we?
Yeah. No?
So we're the problem, the parents.
I'm not saying we're the problem. I think it's both ways.
Sure.
Shaping our behavior and responding in ways that we should, it will help us shape the other person's behavior. But that's a challenge. Whether you're a teacher or you're a parent, you don't want to accept that. Am I the one who's doing wrong? I don't think so. And if the minute you say that I need you to change your interaction, that becomes more of a defensive from an adult saying that, who are you to judge me if I'm doing? I'm not judging you. I'm just giving you tips in order to be successful because I know that, you know, that I know how behavior works. I don't know your child. I don't know what works for you, but I'm giving you tips as far as if you keep responding to those meltdowns, to those yelling, to those crying, to those screaming in public, it's gonna, it's not gonna get better. It's probably gonna escalate more.
Have you ever been in a situation where you saw a complete meltdown and were like, should I go over there?
Yes, but I have to remember that it's I'm not being, you know, invited to give my professional advice in public, but it's very difficult to watch.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure. I'm thinking back whenever Kirsten was little, probably the mishaps I've done.
Yeah.
Her thing now is to get my attention is mom. She'll say, mom, 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 mom. I'd say, Kirsten, I'm right here. Is there something you need me to do?
Yeah.
And she's like, no.
Yeah.
I'm like, why are you saying mom over? I don't know. Yeah. And she'll just look at me. And sometimes she does have a need. Most of the time it's not.
Uh-huh.
But it's usually like right then when I'm in the middle of something.
Yeah. And confirming that you're attending to her, you know?
Yeah. She wants my full attention.
Yeah. Yeah.
She doesn't know what she wants it for. She just wants me right there.
You can establish with her, I don't want to go off track because I can immediately give some tips and suggestions, but establishing nonverbal ways of, instead of saying, mom, how about let's do this instead?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what ABA is, teaching a more socially appropriate behavior. So we come up with an alternative behavior that is not making you like, stop saying mom.
Right.
But you're still attending to her in ways that, hey, I'm checking in, you know, I'm still here. Do you want anything?
Yeah.
And those nonverbal ways or more socially alternative ways of checking in to one another could be a replacement behavior.
And I know one thing that worked great for us. We taught her sign language. Mm-hmm. So if she was like at a performance and wasn't paying attention or trying to wander off, she'd look at me first in the audience and I'd give her a sign like sit mm-hmm. down or mm-hmm. no.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
she tried to do it a little bit and then I'd keep signing.
Yeah.
And then she'd never sign back, but she'd go back to her seat.
Yeah.
And I think that really helped. Like she knew I'm still watching her and mm-hmm. she's still getting my attention, but I reinforced to her like, hey, get back to your spot because we don't act like that.
Yeah. Whether that's an acknowledgement or redirecting to something, I think those nonverbal ways of not making a scene out of it and handling it in a way that it's just between you and I, we know what this means. If I look at you, that means you have to still sit down. And that's what they have ability to understand that and know that, you know?
Absolutely. But I will say, as a parent, it's really hard because we are constantly in the background. Is somebody watching? Is somebody saying something? Is somebody going to turn me in because I, mm-hmm. you know, grab my child's arm a little too forcefully and they have a disability? I mean, it's all of those things that you constantly run through in your head when you're out in public. Or you let her go to the bathroom by herself.
Yes.
You know, it's just all those. I mean, I do it as a parent all the time. And is it the right thing that I'm doing? You know, but maybe I'm the one that needs to have a reset button. And like I told you about Best Up Camp, you know, I was hesitant about doing that. She proves me wrong every single time.
Yeah.
But so, you know, in special education and ABA, what do you hope your students like take away from courses that you've taught in the past or kind of explain about the next phase? Because you've been behind the scenes and you've taught all these things. And what have those experiences? What do you see?
What have I seen? If you remember, Sarah, we have also interacted in parent and a special educator professor ways. So I want future educators, whether they're classroom teachers or therapists, to value parents and parent perspective because they have a huge, they are a huge piece in the puzzle. So without that parent interaction and listening, practicing active listening rather than showing that I'm the expert, you know nothing, you're just a mom, you have to listen to me, that completely builds a wall between a professional and the teacher and the parent relationship. So whether you're an educator, therapist, or whoever you are, be compassionate, be an active listener, and show humility. You know, you have to listen and work with a parent. If you don't have that, then you cannot work with a child with a disability. That's it. For me, that is a deal breaker. If you don't have parent relationship, I want them to know that you are going into a classroom to be a teacher without including and communicating with your parent, you're not going to be successful because at the end of the day, I'm a parent. I want to know how my child is doing.
Right.
Good, had a terrible day. That does not tell me what happened.
Yeah.
Give me more and tell me and talk to me.
Oh, gosh, that's so important, I think. I wish there were some certain circumstances I had known that because then I could have done some reinforcements, you know, at home. Anything else you want to share about, you know, because you're on the board for Oklahoma license for behavioral analyst. So what is that role like for you?
That role means that we are a state where we mandate licensing. So people, when they go through the certification, they have to obtain their license and become a provider in the state of Oklahoma. That means you have to abide by the ethical guidelines and the ethical codes that are mandated to you. And if you make any mistake, then there's a consequence for, you know, whether that's education or reporting or something. And I want our consumers to know as well that when you are hiring BCBAs or looking into behavioral therapy, make sure that your therapists are credentialed not only from the national board, but they're also Oklahoma is a license mandating state.
That's really important. I think I like knowing that on this end,
yeah.
that you guys have those parameters in place. And I'm just going to ask you, what do you think are some of the biggest challenges facing our disability community?
Currently, mm-hmm. we have, you know, I'm hoping that IDEA remains because if any change to the federal law and mandate in our OSEP office, and that's going to impact many of our programs. We need to continue, you know, I can't imagine going back 50 years of what has been done as advocates, the all of this work that has been done to change the life of our students from the school to post-high school is in a challenge right now. And I'm hoping that people understand the impact of some of these federal mandates that are or offices being closed. How does that impact to our community and to our schools? Because as a state, we all need checks and balances. Yeah. So we can't just assume that one state can do a better job than the others. We still have that right now. That's why we see number of people with autism in New Jersey higher than in the state of Oklahoma. People evaluate the services from one state to another. But there has to be a federal mandate and accountability and checks and balances in place. Mm-hmm.
I'm just so appreciative. You just keep opening doors of opportunities for our loved ones. And I think that's what's so inspiring about the work that you do and your leadership. And I know we're so appreciative of the contracts that we have to further those, you know, education and job opportunities for our loved ones. So, Dr. Bagdane, thank you so much joining us today and sharing your insight experience and just really your overall dedication to our disability community. Your leadership and compassion continue to inspire us. We're working in a more inclusive future. But before we wrap up, we have an exciting announcement from the Down Syndrome Association. We have our fashion show coming up January 30th. That's on a Friday, the Uniquely 21 Fashion Show. It'll be at the Criterion in downtown Oklahoma City. It's an incredible night that celebrates the confidence, individuality, and style of our self-advocates. So come out. It's a great show. You've been. Uh-huh. And see them on the runway as the stars of the show. It's just a fun night filled with fashion, fun, and purpose, all while supporting DASCO. It's one of our fundraisers. Tickets are on sale. You can get those at our website at dsaco.org/fashion show. And the general admission tickets are $50. The VIP tickets are $150. That includes dinner, drink vouchers, and the reserved seating. So just head over there and grab some tickets before they sell out. But thank you for listening to DASCO Up for Discussion. And be sure to subscribe, leave us a review, and share this episode with others who believe in inclusion and empowerment. We're also seeking sponsors for our podcast. So any sponsors or donors out there that would like to be featured on our show, please let us know. But until next time, remember, inclusion starts with awareness, but it goes through action. Thank you so much. Bye.